Good evening, everybody. Welcome back to the Mythgard Academy. This is session number 19 of Till We Have Faces. And this evening, we are going to finish the second chapter of part two, which means we'll be halfway through part two, which I still aim to take my time with. We'll see how far we can get through tonight. The series of dreams and visions. Well, let's just say, thinking of Orawal's words last time, the series of experiences that Orawal has here, following up from the things that we have done before. Okay, so remember, as we go through, it gets really intense in these later chapters, but it is more important than ever to be remembering as carefully as you can all of the things that came before, right? So I'm going to be frequently asking, and just be on the lookout for this, even before I ask, be on the lookout for this. That is connections, making connections, noticing things that recall observations that we've made before. The critical thing this is the essential. This is like where it all comes down, right? How you know, how you can feel confident that you're understanding a complicated thing like the end of Till We Have Faces, right? That you're really kind of picking up what Lewis is putting down and not just kind of free associating yourself or kind of launching off into your own ideas, right, based on the text. Not that that's a horrible thing to do, right? I mean, if a story spins you off into like cool ideas of your own, like, that's cool. But if the goal is to try to receive what C.S. Lewis is saying in these chapters, the way to do that is to make sure that we are rooting the conclusions that we draw in the text all the way through. And as we saw last time, Lewis does a remarkable job of pulling things together in the last few chapters of this book. We will continue to see many, many, many references, which we should be picking up on and putting together. Kal-El Ross, you're right. There's no way to understand this book the first time through. Agreed. And by the way, this is one of the reasons, of course, why it is always so easier to understand a book the second time you read it, right? Because one of the hardest parts, of course, of parsing the data when you're studying a work of literature is there's so much you don't know what to pay attention to, right? Sometimes a particular pattern or a particular trend or a particular theme or idea will kind of obtrude itself on your attention, and maybe that will turn out to be really interesting and important and understand, you know, in like the direction that the story is going, and maybe not. Some authors are kind of more deliberate and explicit about signposting that kind of thing than others. But once you have read a book through the first time and you return to it the second time, one of the primary things I think that is different in that experience of reading a thing for the second time is that you have a kind of orientation. Like you might not have gotten everything the first time, right? You almost certainly didn't really put everything together that first time, but you saw enough at least to notice things the second time, right? So that the second time you're kind of primed to notice particular things, and you have some sense of what is going to be important, right? What you're going to need later on, as you'll be remembering the end of the book, and you'll be connecting it to some of those things in the beginning as you go along. And so that's one of the reasons why, I mean, for many of you, I know this is your first time through the book, but it's one of the reasons why I've been trying to sort of shape this discussion. You'll remember I've been continually saying things like, this passage might not have jumped out at you, but trust me, it's going to be important later on, right? Like all of those little references to the growth of Orawal's love for Bardia, right? Which then kind of bear fruit ultimately in the confrontation with Ansett, which we discussed a couple weeks ago. Anyway, that's just sort of one example, and we'll see other things. So I've tried to help guide the selection process this time through to give you an unfair advantage if it's your first time through. But still, we're going to be doing that kind of assembly and looking through together as we continue. All right, but let's get back to it. So you will remember that this insight, this connection of herself with Ungut, and especially her kind of retroactively fitting her draining the life out of Bardia, right? That's one of the things that she's been kind of putting together, right? So you will recall that where we ended last time was her response, her initial response to this realization, to the realization that she is Ungut, having pretty much despised Ungut and everything about Ungutness, right, for her whole life. This realization that she herself is Ungut, that everything that she hated about the gods, which we saw even her condemning in that recent scene when she was sitting during the ritual, right, when she was sitting in the house of Ungut, and we heard there for sort of the last time those reactions about the worship of Ungut, the Glomish traditions about sacrifice and Ungut and stuff and all of that, the particular emphasis on how Ungut and the worship of Ungut, like the paradox, right, that Ungut is supposed to be a goddess of fertility who is supposed to be giving life, it's supposed to be about life and birth and new things growing, right, whether it's babies or the cattle or the corn, right. And yet, the perception, the insight of Orawal was that it was all about taking. It was all about the devouring, right? Not about giving. And that, you know, all of these things, the house of Ungut was like this sink into which, money and beasts and blood and the seed of men and the lives of the girls and, you know, all of these things were taken and nothing given back. Right. Yeah, Maureen, exactly. That whole church ritual was a birth metaphor. And yet, in the midst of that, like in the very center, literally the center of that whole birth metaphor ritual, she is thinking about Ungut as the bloated spider at the middle of the web, right? Taking from everyone and never giving anything back. And yeah, there are lots of, we were talking a little bit last time about how Orawal doesn't seem to draw any, like, positive conclusions from this. Jackie, I think what you're pointing to is actually really interesting, right? That most people do seem to regard Ungut as a successful goddess, right? She has blessed the people. It actually kind of does seem to work. This most dramatically witnessed at the sacrifice of Psyche, right? When all of a sudden, all of the, you know, the curses that had been laid upon Glom immediately dissipate as soon as the great sacrifice is made. As if it were legit, right? As if Ungut actually were acting to bless Glom. Had it been exactly true, right, that Ungut was pouring out her blessings in response to the people's offering of the great sacrifice, it would have looked exactly like that, right? Which even the fox acknowledged, right? And as Jackie was pointing out, Orawal also is a great queen who has been the source of blessing after blessing for Glom, right? And so the kind of this sort of paradoxical, simultaneous giving and taking, right? To be both the bloated spider and, you know, the blessing hand of fertility, right? That does seem to be, Jackie, I agree, something that Ungit and Orwal also have in common. Carrie says, does Orwell think that just because she had a part of the great blessing with her actions and position, that it was not the gods doing? She is just a little queen in a wide world, after all. There's a certain parallel there. I would certainly say, Carrie, of course, for those of you who don't recognize the quotation, or the slant quotation, the reference there is, of course, to the end of The Hobbit, in Gandalf and Bilbo's conversation. And I do think that we do see Orwell, the queen, kind of taking for granted herself. Certainly right now, when she is assessing herself and feeling that she has been a plague, right? That she, like, the thought, I am Ungit, is nothing but hateful to her at this moment, right? So you'll remember her immediate response is to attempt to kill herself. She wants to stab herself with her sword, the same sword with which she saved Bardia, the same sword with which she killed Argon in the duel back at the beginning of her reign, right? But she can't. She physically can't. She can't wield the sword anymore. She's too weak. She's too frail. She's too old. So she wants to commit suicide. She wants to destroy herself in a kind of expiation, right? But at the very least, she has made the decision. She wants to stop being Ungit, right? Yes, it was our nearly Turin moment where she addressed her sword right before she was going to stab herself with it, though it didn't respond, right? Yes. When that fails, she goes to Plan B, and that's where we left off. The day passed somehow. All days pass. And that's great comfort, unless there should be some terrible region in the Deadlands where the day never passes. But when the house slept, I wrapped myself in a dark cloak and took a stick to lean on, for I think the bodily weakness which I die of now must have begun about that time. Then a new thought came to me. My veil was no longer a means to be unknown. It revealed me. All men knew the Veiled Queen. My disguise now would be to go bareface. There was hardly anyone who had seen me unveiled. So, for the first time in many years, I went out bareface, showed that face which many had said, more truly than they could know, was too dreadful to be seen. It would have shamed me no more to go buff naked, for I thought I would look as like Ungit to them as I had seen myself to be in that mirror beneath the earth. As like Ungit, I was Ungit, I and her, and she and me. Perhaps if any saw me, they would worship me. I had become what the people and the old priest called holy. I went out as often before by the little eastern doorway that opens on the herb garden, and thence with endless weariness through the sleeping city. I thought they would not sleep so sound if they knew what dark thing hobbled past their windows. Once I heard a child cry. Perhaps it had dreamed of me. If the shadow brute begins coming down into the city, the people will be greatly afraid, said the old priest. If I were Ungit, I might be the shadow brute too, for the gods work in and out of one another as of us. Okay. So, what do you notice? And when I say what you notice, what I'm primarily asking, what connections do you see? What should we be remembering? Tell me the things we should be remembering when we read this passage. Yes, Devorah, that was the first thing I was thinking of too. Psyche going out into the city and the people worshiping her, right? And notice this is another example of an irony of which Orwell is painfully unaware, right? She is thinking of herself only as hateful. And when she says, perhaps if they saw me, they would worship me. She is being sardonic, both about herself and about Unget herself, right? They worship that hateful Unget, that horrible, hateful Unget. Maybe they would worship me too, right? But do you see one step further from, with Devorah's observation? Yes, we should be remembering when Psyche went out into the same streets of this same city and was worshipped by the people, right? What should we be remembering? There's a line we should be remembering. Orwell's not remembering it, but we should be. You also shall be Psyche. Orwell doesn't remember it in this moment. But the god said to her, you also shall be Psyche. And here she is imagining she is going to get worshipped in the street just like Psyche did. Now, it's not the same. It seems completely different. She's imagining that she would be worshipped because of how horrible, how ugly, how disgusting she is. She's this hideous crone, this Unget thing. But they worship the Unget thing, so they'd probably worship her. Again, it's a scathing remark from her, meant as an insult to herself, meant as an insult to Unget, but as an insult to herself doubly. And yet, there's this ring to that. It's clear that there's more here than she realize. And yes, Cal Elros, this whole episode of her heading out to the stream is about the most acute example of you also shall be Psyche that we've gotten. It absolutely is. It absolutely is. By the way, what's she doing? Like, she's trying to kill herself. Why? Why? Because she is the accursed. There is also a parallel between this and the great sacrifice. It's also a reversal, right? But remember the mystery that was said, which the fox tried to poke holes in and failed to poke holes in, about the great sacrifice, about the accursed, right? Which is it, the fox said? In one moment, the accursed is the most hideous, horrible, disgusting, terrible creature in the land, worthy of, you know, the worst kind of death, right? And the next minute, you say the sacrifice, the great sacrifice, is the bride of the god, right? Most blessed, most beautiful, most perfect. Which is it? Says the fox. And the old priest of Unget says, this is where your philosophy fails. Why should it not be both? And what do we see? It is both. Psyche and Orwell are both the accursed. She also shall be Psyche. And in the two of them, we see both of those things at the same time. Not simultaneously within her time frame, right? But in our picture, right, in our vision of these things, we can see them both together, right? Why shouldn't the sacrifice be both the accursed and the blessed? Notice how she, Orwell, herself, is not thinking about this. But she's remembering the conversation about the great sacrifice. Remember, about the great sacrifice, the great offering. This quotation, right? If the shadow brute begins coming down into the city, the people will be greatly afraid, said the old priest. She's remembering what the priest said on the occasion of the decision to sacrifice Psyche, to make the great offering. right? The threat was, if the great offering is not made, the Shadow Brute himself might come down into the city, and the people will be greatly afraid. And she is like, if I were Ungit, I might be the Shadow Brute also. Why would Psyche's husband conceal his face? Why would he only allow himself to be seen in the darkness? Everyone, the fox and Bardia, both agree, says Orawal. Why? Why? Remember why? Because there was something, there must be something shameful in him, right? Because he must have some reason to hide his face, something he doesn't want you to see. And that dynamic, of course, it was Orawal who insisted on that. It was Orawal who refused to believe Psyche's own understanding of that, Psyche's own trust for the god, right? Yes, Liz, he must be accursed somehow. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And now she, Orawal herself, when she walks out into the city unveiled, the unveiling now has this new meaning, right? She now realizes. It's like, remember again that passage when she was talking about the speculation about what was beneath her veil because nobody knew, right? It's almost as if Orawal herself didn't realize what was under her veil, right? That question that Orawal was asking about the god of the mountain to Psyche, right? Why would he conceal his face if he has nothing to hide? Becomes increasingly relevant to herself. And now she's disguised herself by going barefaced. She's revealed her ugliness. And she is self-consciously, it's like she is realizing that she herself was covering her face because she had something to hide. For I thought I would look as like Ungit to them as I had seen myself to be in that mirror beneath the earth. As like Ungit, I was Ungit. I in her and she in me. It's her Ungitness. Her loathsomeness. Not just her physical ugliness that she's had since she was a child. But her deep spiritual ugliness as well. Her Ungit ugliness. She was hiding that. And now, she's revealed that. But yet, she's revealed in order to disguise herself. And she's tottering through the darkness in the night of the empty city, trying to conceal herself from anyone's sight, trying to make it so that nobody notices her and nobody recognizes her, so that nobody tries to stop her, of course. Right? But here she is acting out the very concealment, right? The attention is being drawn. Our attention is being drawn to that concealment, that she has been hiding herself because she has so much to be afraid of, to be ashamed of, right? Yeah. And yes, Sharon, you're right that Psyche did also seem to think that she was Ungit to the people in her own way when she went out. Yes. Especially when she went out to heal them, right? When they were ill, and she was putting her hands on them. And she was like, I don't know. Maybe it did work, right? Maybe the gods were working through her in this way. Yes, Cal Elra, she was bringing comfort to the people, as Ungit does. Yes, she was. She was. But that last insight that Orawal has here on this page, for the gods work in and out of one another as of us, we can see her beginning to point to some of the kind of mysteries that the priest of Unget was saying, the things that the fox wouldn't accept because they did not make the kind of sense that he was insisting that they make, right? There was a mystery beyond the fox's comprehension. Maybe, perhaps, like that lowest version of the pillar room that she went down to with her father in her dream, the one carved out of the living stone, was way below any dens that foxes could make, right? And yes, Leif, you're absolutely correct to remember John's language, both in the Gospel of John and in the first epistle of John, certainly, about the I and me, I and them and you and me, the he abides in you and you abide in him language. Yes. I don't think it's essential here. That is to say, I don't think you're going to like not understand this, but there is a little crumb to point towards a more specifically Christian applicability of this moment contained in that. Is that language, I was Unget, I and her and she and me, is that an overt echo of the Apostle John? Heck yeah, all day long. 100%. Okay, anyway. Let's keep going. So at last, fainting with weariness, out beyond the city and down to the river, I myself had made it deep. The old Shenet, as she was before my works, would not, save in spate, have drowned even a crone. I had to go a little way along the river, to a place where I knew that the bank was high, so that I could fling myself down, for I doubted my courage to wade in and feel death first up to my knee, and then to my belly, and then to my neck, and still to go on. When I came to the high bank, I took my girdle and tied my ankles together with it, lest even in my old age I might save my life or lengthen my death by swimming. Then I straightened myself, panting from the labor, and stood foot fast like a prisoner. I hopped, what blending of misery and buffoonery it would have looked if I could have seen it, hopped with my strapped feet a little nearer to the edge. Yeah, Morgulhammer, she is referring to herself when she says even a crone. Yeah, yeah. She's definitely talking about herself when she says it would not have drowned even a crone. Yes. Is this her version of Psyche being tied to the tree? Fire Swans, yes. Her standing there bound like a prisoner. Given the hints that we've already had to think about the Great Offering, to think about her as accursed and the parallel between the two, remembering Psyche chained to the tree, yes, I do think that is exactly one of the things we're supposed to be remembering here. Yes. Maureen is saying another scene by a river, and Liz says, yes, once again at the river between life and death and being turned back. Yes, we absolutely should remember that river up in the valley on the mountain, right? The one that separated the Valley of the Gods from the mortal land where Bardia and Grom had to stay, right? Yes. Absolutely. And so remember that river. Remember that that river was the boundary between the mortal realm and the divine realm, or at least the mortal realm and the sort of traditional realm. Really what it was is not exactly the divine realm so much as the place where the divine and the mortal came together. That is like the place where the divine realm touched down on this earth. Psyche founded that. We talked about Psyche being in this sort of state of transition, right, between mortality and divinity, and how she was undergoing this sort of gradual apotheosis. She was being transitioned into the divine world. She had not ascended yet, right? But that transition seemed to be happening. And she imagined that it might be possible for Orawal also to do that, right? That she would be first enabled to see it, right? And then enabled, to visit again and then to stay. That she was welcomed across the river. That Psyche was enabled to bring her to the palace, even though Orawal couldn't see the palace while she was there. I'm not referring to that one glimpse. I mean, while she was sitting there with Psyche, still represented a kind of permission, right? And yes, she was able to cross that mountain river only by holding Psyche's hand, being pulled across by Psyche's strength, right? Yes. So that river, that seemed to be the primary significance of the river before. Here, it's very clearly about death, right? About her standing on the edge of life. And she is seeking death. The river is death to her. And that, Devorah, I am thinking about... Ooh, let me come back to that awesome observation of yours, Devorah, in just a second. But you were right. You were mentioning before her doubting her courage to go progressively, slowly and deliberately into the river, to feel death first up to my knee, then to my belly, then to my neck, and still to go on, right? It is explicitly to her the river of death. And she feels that the only way that she will have the courage to embrace death, to enter into, not to cross. We're not talking about what's on the other side exactly. Or if it is the other side that she's going to, it's a more metaphysical other side, right? But it's explicitly tied to death here. And of course, as we were noticing, that's the moment when she looks like the sacrifice, bound up like the sacrifice was bound. Marking also, because it was, to use Psyche's words, a kind of death, right? When she was sacrificed and then taken by the rough and tumble west wind to the valley of the gods, to the house of the god, right? So anyway, Devorah, I wanted to come back to your other observation here. When the other river, the river on the mountain, was flooded, as it was when the storm came in, when the destruction came, right? She couldn't cross the river, right? She wanted to. She wanted to go over and find Psyche, to try to find her, to help her, to comfort her, to die with her, right? But she couldn't cross the river because of the flood state of the river. And as Devorah points out, she herself has dredged the River Shenet, her works that she reminds us of in that first paragraph. She is the one who has made the Shenet, the River of Gloam, deep, right? Deep enough to drown in. It can only be the River of Death for her, for a crone, right? Because of the work that she did to put it into flood permanently, right? I love that connection, Devorah. I hadn't been thinking about that at all. And that's a really interesting connection. The god, the anger of the god flooded the river before, and made it impassable to her. She has flooded the river now herself. And made it into, at least potentially, the river of death, a river that will drown her, that can drown her, right? Yeah, drowning in her own work reminds you of the many pillar rooms, Jackie? Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. Liz, I agree. I was talking about the many levels of irony involved, many of which Orwell herself is still totally unaware of, in the her being psyche and in the peril with the sacrifice as well. So Liz says part of the problem is that it's not sacrifice in the sense of giving up something of value. It's that Orwell sees no value in herself. First, she has to learn that she is Ungot. Then she needs to learn that she is not an evil. Yes, but it's not just a progression like that. That's the thing. I do think we need to remember the caution of the old priest of Ungot, who was kind of horrible in some ways, but also, I think, kind of won the argument with the fox, right? Even Psyche agrees with him about some of these things. And that is... and that is that there is a mystery here. There are multiple things happening on multiple levels at once. It is multiple things. Morgul Hamster, thinking about... Morgul Hamster is thinking about, is it really an act of sacrifice if you're killing yourself, but only thinking of yourself? You're both the victim and the executioner. Yes. But remember, the accursed, that's what the accursed was. It was about expiating the sin of the people, right? There is uncleanness. There is something wrong, capital W, right? Deeply wrong in Gloam. The evil that needs to be removed. That's what the great sacrifice was about. That's what the accursed was. The one who was most guilty. Guilty of something horrible. Guilty of something that brought the specific anger and curse of Ungot upon them. And the only way to expiate it is by blood. And not just anybody's blood. Not bulls. The blood of bulls and goats would not suffice. The blood of a criminal taken in war would not suffice. Right? Only the blood of the accursed could expiate the sin. Could remove the stain that was placed on Gloam, that was part of the terms of the great sacrifice. And remember, that was Psyche. Because Psyche had, according to the priest, claimed to be Ungot, had received sacrifice that was due to Ungot. So, claiming to putting yourself in the place of Ungot, believing that you are Ungot, is what would make you the accursed and mean that in order to expiate the sin from the nation, right, the sin from the land of Gloam, you would have to die, right? And no, Morgul Hamster, she is not thinking of her people right now. There's one sense in which she is. She sees herself as a plague, as a pestilence. She is thinking of her people in the sense that she thinks, just as she was thinking that the people of Gloam would be so much better off without the House of Ungot when she was sitting in it and thinking of all the things that the House of Ungot takes and gives nothing back, right? The corollary, or not the corollary, the conclusion, right? The sort of outcome of that observation is, therefore, Gloam would be blessed by the removal of this place, the removal of Ungot. And she is thinking the same about herself. She is saying, I am Ungot. I am as horrible as Ungot. I have done harm. I am continually doing harm. I am the bloated spider at the center of the web. I should be destroyed. And is she thinking about, like, is this a selfless act, right? Is Orwell standing there on the edge of the river saying, like, it is a far, far better thing that I do now? No, that is not what is happening here, right? And yet she was thinking of her people in a sense, right? In the sense that everyone would be better off without her. Think also, by the way, of what a reversal that is of the fantasy she was having on the night before Psyche lights the lamp in the god's bedchamber. That is, remember the fantasies of her death and her being on her laid out in her bier and everybody realizing how wonderful she was and how much they loved her and how good and unappreciated she was, right? She was having fantasies then about how little people appreciated her and how much they might appreciate her when she died, right? Now, it's the exact opposite, right? Everyone loves and respects her. But she knows the truth. The truth is she is Unget, right? And she is the bloated spider. And everyone will be better off if she does die, right? So again, Morgul Hamster, it's not her language. She's not saying, I am the accursed and I must die for the sake of the people. She's not saying that. I am pointing out, like, we can see that. We can see we are being presented the parallel. She also shall be Psyche, and she is being Psyche. She doesn't realize it, right? She's not putting it together yet, but we can see it, right? We can see how, despite her intentions, despite her own interpretations of what's going on, there is a deep similarity between this. We are seeing the other, we are seeing the flip side, right? Is the great sacrifice the bride of the god, or is the great sacrifice the most, you know, the accursed, the most hideous and awful embodiment of all, you know, sin and horribleness, both at once? And we're seeing now both, right? And both sides. Remember, Mrs. Manrake, remember that line. What a blending of misery and buffoonery it would have looked if I could have seen it. Remember that. Remember her imagining how it would look to her if she could see it. That's going to be relevant later on. Okay. Yeah, it's hard to sort through Morgul Hamster. And by the way, I don't want you to feel like I absolutely welcome all of those kinds of questions. I want to make sure people don't misunderstand the kinds of things that I'm saying or the kinds of readings that I'm suggesting, right? I'm suggesting things that I think the text is kind of presenting to us and bringing together. But it is important to keep the distinction. It has been crucial, you'll remember, throughout this story, the narrator, Orawal as narrator, Orawal as the author of the book, right? Orawal writing the book has been one of the most important themes of this entire book, right? So distinguishing between what we as readers can see when we put this stuff together and what Orawal, the narrator herself, can see, that's a crucially important theme that has been repeated itself all the way through the book, right? So don't at all be shy about distinguishing, you know, or asking questions, because I don't want to misrepresent things. I think it's very important that Orawal does not even understand that she is making the great offering here. Like, she doesn't see that parallel. She does not yet see that she is Psyche. And that is really important, and we have to remember that. Let's keep going. A voice came from beyond the river. Do not do it. Instantly. I had been freezing cold till now. A wave of fire passed over me, even down to my numb feet. It was the voice of a god, Who should know better than I? A God's voice had once shattered my whole life. They are not to be mistaken. It may well be that by trickery of priests, men have sometimes taken a mortal's voice for a god's. But it will not work the other way. No one who hears a god's voice takes it for a mortal's. Lord, who are you? Said I. Do not do it, said the god. You cannot escape Unget by going to the Deadlands, for she is there also. Die before you die. There is no chance after. Bricktail says, finally the god speaks clearly. Oh, sorry, JJ, you had asked a really important question there. Let me not miss that completely. If I'm understanding you properly, JJ, you're asking, I was saying that Orawal is unaware of the parallel between herself and Psyche, unaware of the great offering thing that I was discussing. And JJ asked, just the Orawal who's performing the actions or the Orawal who is writing about the actions? One of the things that I would say, JJ, and I think one thing that we've seen in book two is that those two things are way closer together, right? There was a long gap of time between most of the events of book one and the writing of book one. And the effect of kind of crossing back over that time, of looking back through her memory and seeing again the things that had happened in the past, had a big impact on her, as she describes, right? The narrator of book two, Orawal as narrator of book two, has been more immediate. I don't say completely identical. But it's closer. It's closer. Yes. I would say once again, sorry, several people, Lord, who are you? That's another New Testament quotation. St. Paul. That's what Paul says when he has his vision, when Jesus appears to him on the road to Damascus. The answer, of course, you will remember, is I am Jesus whom you are persecuting. I am... What do I want to say about this? We are going to talk more about New Testament stuff later. That, I think, will be a little bit inescapable. But I would point out here, both here and the I and her and she and me reference that we were looking at on the earlier slide. Although these are, I think, very clear references to the New Testament, and they're not accidental. We're meant to think of that. We're meant to think of, you know, Jesus' discourse to and prayer for the disciples in the last second half of John, you know, in John 15 and following. We're, you know, John 15 to 17. We're meant to think of, to remember Paul on the road to Damascus. But thus far, I would suggest that most of those connections, that is to say, I think that the primary force of those connections that Lewis is making is sort of for applicability. The main thing that I would insist on, I think I would insist here, you don't have to know it to get it. This is not the kind of thing that if you don't recognize, if you don't know the New Testament and you don't get the New Testament references, you're going to totally miss the point that Lewis is making here. Yeah, you see what I mean? Like, do you see the distinction that I'm making there? Thus far, like with the two New Testament references that we've been looking at there, in those two slides that I just referred to, I think that Lewis is suggesting some Christian applicability of these things. But again, I don't think we have to be thinking of St. Paul here in order to understand what's going on with Orwell. And in those cases, I'm going to mostly let them go. I won't let this one go entirely, though. I think it's important enough, or rather, again, you can get it without it, but if you do get the reference, it'll help. So let me explain a little bit. Paul, whose name was Saul of Tarsus. Saul of Tarsus was a very devout Jew, a Pharisee, whose devotion and zeal was manifested in the fact that he was outraged by the claims of the first Christians and the things that they were saying about this dude, Jesus of Nazareth, such that he persecuted them and killed them. He was pursuing them. He was on the road to Damascus because he was going to Damascus, which was another major city, though outside Israel, outside Judea. He was on the way there to persecute people there, to haul them back, to chase them down and haul them back to Jerusalem in order to be executed. He, on that road, on the road to Damascus, had a vision where Jesus appeared to him and said, "Paul, why do you persecute me?" And he says, "Lord, who are you?" And he says, "I am Jesus of Nazareth, whom you persecute, whom you've been persecuting." And then the vision of Jesus says this thing, which when people read it in the King James, doesn't come across well. And that is, "Paul, it is hard for you to kick against the pricks. It is hard for you to kick against the goads." The imagery is an imagery from animal husbandry, right? You use a pointed stick to poke at cows, right? In order to make them go in a particular direction. And if the cow tries to push back against the goad, it doesn't go well for them. That's the point of the pointed stick. Right, is that if the cow tries to kick, which is a natural impulse for them when they feel something pointy stabbing them in the backside, they will often kick back against it. And when they do, it hurts more, right? The point, because they are joining the force of the poking with the force of their own kicks, right? And so this is the metaphor that the vision of Jesus uses to Paul and characterizes what he has been doing, hit the trajectory of his career to that point, where he thought he was standing up for truth, where he thought he was defending with zeal the God of his fathers. And instead, what he's been doing is kicking against the goads. He's being pushed in a particular direction. He's being steered in a particular direction, and he's fighting it, right? And thereby just making it harder for him. You may as well come quietly, Saul, is one of the, yes, to be steered. That's exactly right. Curious Chance. Exactly. Yeah. That was a, pun intended. Anyway, you see the relevance? We don't need to get deeper into the story of Saul of Tarsus than that. But you see the relevance, right? What's Orwell been doing from page one? Complaining about the gods. Protesting about how horrible the gods are. Right? Resisting the gods and everything about them. So when she says, Lord, who are you? When she utters the words of St. Paul in that moment, I think it helps. It does help a little bit. Again, it's not that we couldn't get this without it, but it does. The reference does push in a particular direction, kind of like a pointed stick, right? Orwell has only been making it hard on herself. She has been resisting the god, and there's in the end it's not going to do her any good, right? Anyway, remember all of the stuff that I was just alluding to about the meeting between the mortal and the divine that we saw on the mountain, right? That frontier between the mortal and divine, where the conversations between Psyche and Orwell took place, right? Remember Psyche's account of the experience of being a mortal and encountering the divine, the self-consciousness, even the shame, as she described it, of mortality. It may well be that by trickery of priests, men have sometimes taken a mortal's voice for a god's. But it will not work the other way. No one who hears a god's voice takes it for a mortal's. By the way, do you see the irony? Right? The irony going all the way back, somebody was saying this, at the beginning, but I forget who it was. Bricktales, maybe? How Orwell had wanted the gods to speak directly, had been complaining about, like, oh, why won't the gods make their will known clearly, right? And not only does that happen here, and again, how much clearer could it be? Do not do it. All right. I think I'm receiving a message, right? But note how she says, just remember how retroactively ironic it is for Orwell to be saying, no one who hears a god's voice takes it for a mortal's. When you hear the voice of the gods, it is unmistakable. Yes. Apparently that doesn't mean that any time the gods speak to you, it is completely unmistakable and undeniable. Because she has shown, like, the one who showed this tremendous capacity for choosing not to hear the messages that were being sent to her from the gods, right? Is now forced to confess on this, the second occasion she's ever heard the voice of a god speaking clearly, directly to her. No one who hears a god's voice takes it for a mortal's. So, a god's voice had once shattered my whole life, she says. And what does the God's voice say now? Do not do it. Don't commit suicide. Don't throw yourself in the river of death. And it explains. You cannot escape Ungit by going to the Deadlands, for she is there also. Die before you die. There is no chance after. Let's break that into two parts here. You cannot escape Ungit by going to the Deadlands, for she is there also. So, escape Ungit? Is that what she was doing? She was trying to kill Ungit. She was trying to escape from being Ungit, right? But the god characterizes her attempted suicide here as escaping Ungit, an attempt on her part to escape Ungit. So it's as if she, Orawal, is a prisoner of Ungit. Kind of like Orawal was imprisoned in the womb of the queen, so that she shrank and shrank, and she was determined to kill her, Orawal. The queen was determined to kill Orawal. It's kind of like that, I guess. That she tied up there, bound as if she is the great sacrifice, is trying to escape, to escape Ungit, right? Fire Swan says she can't escape that part of herself, the Ungit part. She's trying to punish. She's trying to execute it. Again, in that too, it is like the great offering, right? This is a suicide, but it's also an execution. She's a queen, after all. She's passed judgment on herself. Again, in that too, it is like the great offering, right? And yet, the god characterizes it as a kind of escape. And Leaf says, it's getting a little circular here. To which I would say, you ain't seen nothing yet. Okay. Anyway, yeah, that'll be a thing. That'll be a thing. I and her and she and me. Don't forget that kind of thing. Right. Or what was it, the other one? For the gods work in and out of one another as of us. Don't forget that either. Okay. Instead of saying, so don't try to escape Ungit. You can't escape Ungit by going to the Deadlands, for she's there also. That's not going to work, right? Die before you die. There is no chance after. What does that mean? I have no idea. Let's keep going. No, seriously. Let's not talk about this. Again, this is where I'm going to try to be a helpful, I've read this before, and try to guide you a little bit. And my suggestion is, let's just wait on this, right? We don't have enough. I'm just telling you, we don't have enough. We don't have enough material to understand this yet. It'll make more sense later on. But we must remember it, right? Die before you die. There is no chance after. Okay. Keep going. Lord, I am Ungit, she says. So notice she tries to clarify with the god, right? Like, oh, hang on. No, wait. I'm not trying to escape Ungit. I am Ungit. Like, it's worse than that, right? Though, of course, one is tempted to say, maybe it's Orawal who doesn't understand, right? I think this is part of a reminder. That is what her imprisonment by Ungot consists in. She is imprisoned by Ungot by being Ungot. Right. But there was no answer. And that is another thing about the voices of the gods. When once they have ceased, though it is only a heartbeat ago, and the bright, hard syllables, the heavy bars or mighty obelisks of sound are still master in your ears, it is as if they had ceased 1,000 years before, and to expect further utterance is like asking for an apple from a tree that fruited the day the world was made. Oh, man. The similes and metaphors in that paragraph. Whoo, boy. The voice of the god had not changed in all those years, but I had. There was no rebel in me now. I must not drown, and doubtless should not be able to. I crawled home, troubling the quiet city once more with my dark witch shape and my tapping stick. And when I laid my head on my pillow, it seemed but a moment before my women came to wake me, whether because the whole journey had been a dream, or because my weariness, which would be no wonder, had thrown me into a very fast sleep. Okay. Let's just go back to that paragraph for a second. And that is another thing about the voice. But there was no answer. Stop. What should we be remembering? There's a big one here. But there was no answer. What should we remember? The end of her book! The end of her book! That was the end. That was the end of book one. Right? When she's demanding an answer from the gods, and that she knows that they might punish her, but that punishment itself will merely prove that there is no answer. Right? She says, Lord, I am Ungot. Or no, I think it's more like, Lord, I am Ungot. I think that's what she says. Maybe she says, Lord, I am Ungot. Maybe she says all three of those things. I'm not sure. But in any case, she says that, and then there was no answer. And we absolutely must be remembering the end of book one. And that is another thing about the voices of the gods. When once they have ceased, though it is only a heartbeat ago, and the bright, hard syllables, the heavy bars and mighty obelisks of sound are still master in your ears, it is as if they had ceased 1,000 years before, and to expect further utterance is like asking for an apple from a tree that fruited the day the world was made. Think about this in connection with her demands for an answer from the god in book one, the gods in book one. She doesn't believe the gods can ever give any answer to anything, do ever communicate clearly at all. That was part of her closing argument, remember. But her acknowledgement of what the answer of the gods is like, what the words of the gods are like. Bright, hard syllables. The heavy bars, they're like heavy bars or mighty obelisks of sound. And when those things, when those heavy, enormous syllables are in your ears, they are master in your ears. There's a complete dominance, right? Ambrosius, that's really good. The bars and obelisks makes me think of the description of the god's house on the mountain as Psyche described it, and as Orwell sees it, briefly. Solid pillars and beams and columns, yeah. and all of those things falling, right, in Orwell's vision at the end. But when the gods don't answer, when you speak like she just did, and the god is done talking and is not going to answer, you know that there's not gonna, that no answer will come. How do you know no answer will come? It's as if they had ceased 1,000 years before, even while it's still ringing in your ears. To expect further utterance is like asking for an apple from a tree that fruited the day the world was made. I love that simile. And, yeah, if you're thinking of the magician's nephew, I am too. Yes, the finality, the authoritativeness. One of the things I think about the apple simile there is if you had a tree that fruited on the day the world was made, whose bearing of an apple was part of the very, like, was bound up in the very creation of the world itself. How crazily, ridiculously inappropriate and futile would it be to go to it for a snack and say, "And what have you done for me lately?" Right? So, any fruit today? Right? And disrespectful, Jackie. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. That is what. Yeah. Approaching the tree that bore an apple on the day the world was made, because you're a bit peckish and would rather like a snack, right, is now how she characterizes seeking an answer from the gods. Maybe if the gods have no answer, that's a good thing. Maybe it's an appropriate thing. Yeah, yeah. Jocelyn, I do think we're thinking about the tree in the Garden of Eden. I mean, certainly it's hard not to think about the tree in the Garden of Eden to some extent. And one of the forces of that, I think, is the sense of transgression, right? To ask for an apple of that tree. There are reasons to think that might not pan out, right? Might be a bad idea. And curious chance, you were right. There are two trees that fruited on the day the world was made in Genesis chapter 2. Yeah, the tree of life being the other. Yeah. Anyway, it's just a simile, and she doesn't elaborate on it, but that sense, Jocelyn, I think the primary focus, like the primary weight of the Eden connection there is on the sense of, like, again, that it would be, it wouldn't just be transgressive in the same way it was transgressive for Adam and Eve to eat the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. The tree of the knowledge of good and bad. Tov and Ra, to use the Hebrew. But but we're not talking about Adam and Eve's transgression. We're talking about, from Orwell's perspective, we're talking about somebody later looking back at this, right? Adam and Eve arguably should have known it was a bad idea. We definitely know it would be a bad idea, right? Ambrogius, we'll come back to the gods' love for Psyche, because that's not where the focus, our focus has been since Psyche's departure, really, right? Notice the significance of I must not drown and doubtless should not be able to. There is no rebel in her now. She has changed in the years since she last heard the voice of the god. She's not going to rebel. She submits right away. I must not drown. I'm not allowed. So she goes back home. And furthermore adds, doubtless should not be able to. Whether she's going to comply or not, it's not going to happen. Right. It goes beyond simple obedience and on to the god has said, do not do it. So my doing it can't happen. There is a different kind of faith involved there, a different degree of faith involved there. Whether she throws herself in the river or not, sounds like she ain't drowning tonight, right? That at least is her belief. She's uncertain. We see at the end whether she had been dreaming. Was the whole thing a dream? Or was she just really tired? And she'd been thrown into a very fast sleep. Remember the uncertainty. Is this stuff really happening? Is it just a vision? Is it a dream? Is she asleep? Is she awake and seeing it? Is she asleep and seeing it? Is it actually happening? Is she the only one who can see it? She's not sure about all of these things, right? And the uncertainty of what exactly is happening and where the boundaries are, I think, is an important thing. And yes, Morgul Hamster, I completely agree with you. It kind of feels like it doesn't matter if it's real or dream or vision. She returns and insists on that, right? She keeps bringing it up, the ambiguity, right? Yeah. All right. That's the end of chapter 2 of book 2, but let's start chapter 3. Then the gods left me for some days to chew the strange bread they had given me. I was Ungit. What did it mean? Do the gods flow in and out of us as they flow in and out of each other? And again, they would not let me die till I had died. I knew there were certain initiations, far away at Eleusis in the Greek lands, whereby a man was said to die and live again before the soul left the body. But how could I go there? Then I remembered that conversation which his friends had with Socrates before he drank the hemlock, and how he said that true wisdom is the skill and practice of death. And I thought Socrates understood such matters better than the fox, for in the same book he has said how the soul is dragged back through the fear of the invisible. So that I even wondered if he had not himself tasted this horror as I had tasted it in Psyche's valley. But by the death which is wisdom, I supposed he meant the death of our passions and desires and vain opinions. And immediately, it is terrible to be a fool, I thought I saw my way clear and not impossible. To say that I was Ungit meant that I was as ugly in soul as she, greedy, blood-gorged. But if I practiced true philosophy, as Socrates meant it, I should change my ugly soul into a fair one. And this, the gods helping me, I would do. I would set about it at once. on the one hand, Orwell points here to a matter that Socrates, or at least Plato, understands better than the fox, right? The fox isn't really a Platonist, though she's read Plato, right? She's read the Death of Socrates. Anyway, so she's here suggesting that perhaps Socrates' understanding, perhaps Socrates' philosophy is even more true than the fox. She resonates with Socrates' words, the way that Socrates talks about death, the way that he talks about the soul. And Cal Elros, you're exactly right to remind us that when Socrates talks about the soul being dragged back through fear of the invisible, of course, the word he would be using is psyche, right? Yes, but anyway, although, as I say, on the one hand, she is saying that she now believes, based on the experiences that she has had, she wonders if Socrates himself had not tasted this horror as I had tasted it in Psyche's Valley. Like, he seems to know what he's talking about, right? When he talks about the soul being dragged back through the fear of the invisible, she's like, oh man, I get that. I've experienced that in my encounter with the god. That her time at the frontier between the divine realm and the mortal realm, and she's like, soul being dragged back through fear of the invisible, oh man, right? Like, that is exactly what it was like. It's so perfect to her characterization. Again, she's like, Socrates must have had an encounter with the god, right? And this, by the way, remember, puts him beyond the fox, because the fox did not acknowledge he believed in the divine nature, right, and all those things, but he did not believe in this kind of an encounter between the mortal and the divine. The fox wouldn't have agreed with this. But if the fox had disagreed with Socrates here, Orwell is here to tell you that Socrates is right and the fox is wrong. But at the same time, while she is in the midst, like in the process of pointing out the weaknesses of the fox's philosophy, she is showing herself here in this paragraph, in the first paragraph of chapter 3, if I'm remembering correctly, she is here proving herself most clearly the disciple of the fox than at any other time. She is philosophizing. She is taking refuge in the fox's whole approach to life. Notice the conclusion she draws. The conclusion she draws is not exactly Plato's conclusion. It's not exactly Socrates' conclusion. It's the conclusion the fox would draw. The fox wouldn't accept the whole fear of the invisible, soul being dragged back through fear of the invisible thing. But her interpretation, she's trying to understand, die before you die. What does that mean? Die before you die. And she's like, Socrates gets death. He understands that, right? But she goes to try to explain it, and she totally pulls a fox on this. By the death which is wisdom, I supposed he meant the death of our passions and desires and vain opinions. A fox would have been jumping up and down and applauding at that point, right? Yeah, that must be that before you die. Die by slaying, by subjecting to death, by putting to death your passions and your desires and your vain opinions. In other words, become a true philosopher. Walk the path of virtue. Cleanse yourself of these deadly things, passions, desires, vain opinions. And if you can do that, then you will have died in that sense prior to death. before you get to the point of death. Socrates says the true wisdom is the skill and practice of death. Well, here's how you do it properly, right? Instead of tying your belt around your ankles and throwing yourself into the river, what you do is first you progress as a philosopher, as the fox would have said, right? You put to death all of those dark things about yourself, and then you are truly prepared for death and can embrace it like Socrates did, right? Arjun Paintbrush, don't think about Aristotle. Aristotle's different, quite different. So don't be thinking about the golden mean and such. We're not in Aristotle. We're in Plato, or we're in Orwell's. I was about to say Platonized version of the fox's philosophy, but it's more like fox-sized versions of Plato's philosophy. Anyway, okay, yeah. So and notice this when she thinks about things this way, the way the fox does, it all makes sense. So first of all, the saying of the god, die before you die. Now, she gets it now. It makes sense, right? But what's better is that she sees her way clear. I thought I saw my way clear and not impossible. I can do this. I can die before I die. I can take the advice of the god. I can achieve that thing. To say that I was Ungud meant that I was as ugly in soul as she. Greedy, blood-gorged. She's not turning away from that fact, but she's now philosophizing it, right? If I practice true philosophy as Socrates meant it, I should change my ugly soul into a fair soul. In that sense, she shall cease to be Ungud. Her first impulse of how to cease to be Ungud was to kill herself. In that way, she would destroy Ungud and thus cease to be Ungud by ceasing to be, right? Now she is going to cleanse her soul by the practice of true philosophy. And this, the gods helping me, she would do. And in that way, she would cease to be Ungud. Great. This, the gods helping me, I would do. I would set about it at once. So how does this go? This is what the fox, like he was saying, this is what you should do, right? This is what the fox believed in. And he talked about how far you progressed in philosophy. And this is what he was talking about, right? But remember that problem the fox had, that he didn't really believe it completely, right? Anyway, okay. The gods helping. But would they help? Nevertheless, I must begin. So she has this doubt, right? She just said that phrase, the gods helping. It's like a thing you throw out. Like you say without thinking about it. It's a kind of thing I think that they say in Gloam. The gods helping me, I will do this, right? And she just said that. And then she just caught herself. Wait. The gods helping me. Wait, will the gods help me do this? But then she's like, hang on, whatever. Nevertheless, I must begin. And it seemed to me that they would not help. I would set out boldly each morning to be just and calm and wise in all my thoughts and acts. But before they had finished dressing me, I would find that I was back and knew not how long I had been back in some old rage, resentment, gnawing fantasy, or sullen bitterness. I could not hold out half an hour. And a horrible memory crept into my mind of those days when I had tried to mend the ugliness of my body with new devices in the way I did my hair or the colors I wore. I'd a cold fear that I was at the same work again. I could mend my soul no more than my face, unless the gods helped. And why did the gods not help? Hang on, we'll get to that in a second. She notices, she thinks she saw her way clear and not impossible. Turned out it was impossible. She tries to practice true philosophy and sucks at it. I could not hold out half an hour. She would set out every morning to do it, and every day she would fail within the first half hour. And then she remembers a horrible memory of the days when she tried to mend the ugliness of my body with new devices. When she still was hoping to make herself pretty, or at least make herself less ugly, by something. Her hair, her clothes, cosmetics, that sort of thing, right? Is there some way I can conceal? I can try to make as if I'm to diminish my own ugliness. And she found she couldn't. It was a failure, and a ridiculous failure. Devorah is remembering the special clothes and makeup and mask that Psyche wore for her sacrifice. Yes. Let's not forget that. I don't want to talk about that too much right now, but yes, let's do remember that. The insight that she has. I had a cold fear that I was at the same work again. That her attempts to make her soul beautiful were just as futile as her attempts to make her body less ugly. She is just ugly. And she couldn't conceal that. She couldn't change that. And she's beginning to come to the same conclusion about her soul. That she's just ungit. And she can't change it. She can't fix it. Unless the gods helped. But why did the gods not help? If she's trying to make herself beautiful, spiritually speaking, if she's trying for her own moral improvement, if she's trying to make her horrible, ugly soul a beautiful soul, she can't do that if the gods don't help. Only the work of the gods can effect that transformation, because she finds herself powerless to do it. But why don't they help? Now, let's keep going. Bye-bye! A terrible, sheer thought, huge as a cliff, towered up before me, infinitely likely to be true. No man will love you, though you gave your life for him, unless you have a pretty face. This is a lesson Orawal, who's been ugly since she was a child. This is what little goblin face has learned in her life. She loved Bardia and saved his life. Who did Bardia love? The hot girl he married without a dowry. Right. Anyway, no man will love you, though you gave your life for him, unless you have a pretty face. So, might it not be? The gods will not love you, however you try to pleasure them, and whatever you suffer, the gods, unless you have that beauty of soul. In either race, for the love of men or the love of a god, the winners and losers are marked out from birth. We bring our ugliness in both kinds with us into the world, with it our destiny. How bitter this was, every ill-favored woman will know. We have all had our dream of some other land, some other world, some other way of giving the prizes, which would bring us in as the conquerors. Leave the smooth, rounded limbs and the little pink and white faces and the hair like burnished gold far behind. Their day ended and ours come. But how if it's not so at all? How if we were made to be dregs and refuse, everywhere and every way? Yeah, Maureen, this is such a painfully sad paragraph, right? By the way, this paragraph and others as we get in these last two chapters are why I was saying from... You remember I was resistant much earlier in our discussion of the book, when people were talking about, like, is Orawal really ugly? Like, are we supposed to does she just think that she's ugly, or is she, like, objectively ugly? Like, what's kind of going on there? And remember, I said at the time, like, I think we're clearly supposed to just accept the fact that she is ugly. Everybody agrees that she's ugly. This is partly why. It's not delusion. Her entire perception of the world has been shaped in part by her ugliness, by the fact that she has received rejection from the beginning. Deep rejection within the context of her society, to the point where it seemed like there was no point to her at all because she was ugly and therefore useless, because the only use for her was to marry a, you know, foreign king or whatever. Like, that was the point of her. And she's no good for that, because no king will have her and no one else can have her, right? She learned the truth at 17 that life was meant for beauty queens. Something like that, Leaf. Yeah, exactly. Yes. But notice what she, like, remember her experience of this thought. She cries out, bye-bye. We've seen people say that. She's reported that in dialogue before, right? That is an exclamation of dismay, which we first hear multiple times from the fox. I think it's a Greek expression, not a Glomish expression. And so she cries out, bye-bye, this Greek exclamation of horror and chagrin, dismay, right? When she's been Greeking it up for the last couple paragraphs, right? She's been trying to be like the fox. She's been trying to come to trying to enact the Greek solution to her problem, right? And then she cries out with the Greek exclamation, bye-bye. And it's the first time she's used this in narration, right? We see in this a spontaneous response from her as she writes, right? Bye-bye. A terrible, sheer thought, huge as a cliff, towered up before me, infinitely likely to be true. Ever had that experience where this huge monstrous thought suddenly appears in front of you that is horrifying to you but infinitely likely to be true, right? Like, as soon as you think it, you're like, oh no, I'm sure that that's the truth. What if, she thinks, my experience of physical ugliness is merely a picture of what is true? Remember, the question that led to this thought was the question, why did the gods not help? Oh no. What if the gods don't help you to beautify your soul? Because, spiritually speaking, they're not interested in a pig wearing lipstick, right? She tried to mend the ugliness of her body with devices, with her hair and clothes, but it was no good. She wasn't fooling anybody, right? Nothing that she could do made men think she was not ugly, right? What if the gods would what if the gods feel exactly the same way? What if her ugliness of soul is as intrinsic to her as her ugliness of body? What if you're marked out from birth as a winner or loser, just as she was physically? Right? Loser in the, you know, lottery of life. Because she's so ugly. Would never be loved. And what if that's true of your souls too? Infinitely likely to be true. That would explain a lot. It would explain why the gods don't help. Right? How if we were made to be dregs and refuse everywhere in every way? Notice she points to this fantasy. Fantasy, she says, every ill-favored woman will know how bitter this idea is. Every ugly person understands this. And understands perhaps that dream, that maybe in another reality, in another sense, there would be some other way of giving the prizes which would bring us in as the conquerors. Maybe the pretty girls don't always win. Maybe someday the ugly girls will win. We'll get theirs. But what if they're made to be dregs and refuse everywhere and every way? Well, that's what would happen if you were born with an ugly face, like Orwell knows she was, and with an ugly soul, as she is now believing she must have been. Because look, she can't fix it. It's hardwired. She's just experienced that. Well, shoot. She must be as ugly in soul as she was in body. Emily's a little bothered by her assumption that the only reason Bardia loved his wife was because she was pretty. Agreed, Emily. All I would say is she, Orwell, is in a pretty dark place at this moment. And if she's not being totally fair to Ansett, who is one of those smooth, rounded, limbed, pink and white faced, hair like burnished gold girls, I think she can be forgiven. Was there more to it than that? Yeah, we saw that, and she saw that. Orwell did, I mean, in her conversation with Ansett. She knew that herself. But, yeah. I think we can, if we allow ourselves to enter into this horrible place that she has come to here, as she is, what was her metaphor again? Chewing the strange bread the gods had given her. I think we can probably forgive her for that. Yeah. JJ says, when has Orwell ever exhibited great understanding of any sort of love, even when she exhibited it? True enough. True enough. And I don't think we have reason to believe. I think JJ is very right to remind us of that. We don't have reason to believe that she has come to that insight, that she has yet come to an understanding of love. Coming to believe that you are yourself Unget, that you are the bloated spider sucking away the lives of men, is a kind of step, but it's certainly not a step towards understanding love and how it works, right? Mrs. Manrake, that's interesting. It is possible that Bardia's wife was morally beautiful. She may know that. She may see that. She may emerge from the conversation with Ansett, seeing that, remember the expression, so like Psyche's own, when Ansett was like, Queen, how I begin to think you don't know anything of love at all. Like, why would, remember those moments, right? When Orwell gets the impression that Ansett is not only has been beautiful in a way that she never was, but is also operating on a kind of higher moral level that she doesn't get. Right. That Ansett does understand love in ways that Orwell doesn't, but can in some sense perceive the gap, the distance. Right. Just like she perceived the distance when she accused Psyche of throwing her virginity back in her face, right? In this sense, JJ Orawal is still a complete virgin when it comes to love, in having not experienced it, really, in a sense, right? But yeah. I do think we can infer that Ancid is a good woman. Jackie, I agree with you. And I think that Orawal can infer it. And so, yes, I do think if she thinks of Ancid in this moment, the moment of this paragraph, the moment of this sheer thought, huge as a cliff towering up before her, she looks at Ancid and sees one, if she is one who is meant to be the dregs and refuse everywhere in every way, Ancid is meant to be the conqueror everywhere and every way. She is blessed by the gods, blessed with beauty, blessed with a pretty body and a pretty soul. And Orwell's gotten the short end of every stick. Okay, I can't start on the next dream. I was gonna start on the next dream. I'm not gonna start on the next dream. I can't start on the next dream. So we'll start on the next. We'll do the next dream next time. The dream of the Rams is where we are. So we will do the dream of the Rams next time. There's a non-zero chance we'll get towards the end of chapter 3, in which Orawal gets her moment in court. Right. But first we'll do the dream of the Rams. All right. We'll see. It would be doing the majority of chapter 3 in one go, which we'll see. Not 100% sure it's going to happen, but we'll see. Quick reminder, I'm not going to be here next week. So I won't be available next week. So no class next week, but I'm hoping to have class the week after. I will just put a little proviso. There is a non-zero chance that I might have to cancel. My son is visiting from college, and I don't really know the schedule for the week. I keep saying this in all of my broadcasts because I just don't know. If something comes up and keeps me out, I might have to cancel. But I don't know that that will be the case. So I'm going to plan on the first Wednesday of March. What is it, the 5th or something like that? But anyway, so that's where we'll be. So again, no reading assignments. You should read to the end. Certainly reread chapter 3 in preparation for next time, because that's what we will talk about. There's still a couple. There's still all of chapter 4. we're not that close. we're not that close. Anyway, all right. Thanks, everybody. And I will see you guys hopefully in a fortnight. Bye now.